So today, as you know, this year's series of lectures is about the big ideas of finance. The nice part about finance is probably the simplest of all business school topics. And the reason is we only have six ideas. So if you understand these six ideas, you understand everything there is to understand in finance. And as Darshan pointed out, five of these ideas have won Nobel Prizes. So the only idea which didn't win a Nobel Prize is the first concept, net present value. But that is such a basic concept that nobody had the audacity to claim they came up with the idea. So today, we're going to talk about the third idea in finance.
The Gresham College lecture that you're listening to right now is giving you knowledge and insight from one of the world's leading academic experts. Making it takes a lot of time, but because we want to encourage a love of learning, we think it's well worth it. We never make you pay for lectures, although donations are needed. All we ask in return is this: send a link to this lecture to someone you think would benefit, and if you haven't already, click the follow or subscribe button from wherever you're listening right now. Now, let's get back to the lecture.
If you want to follow this stuff in more detail after my lecture, I do note that there is two books I've written in Chinese as well as in English, so you're welcome to take a look at them. This is exactly the same thing as a lecture, but in considerably more detail. Okay, so what are these six basic ideas? The first idea, which we covered in the first lecture, was that of what we call net present value. Right? The idea is very simple. All it says is, if I want to pay for something, if I want to invest in something, I have to get back more than I invest. That's it. Right? Very simple idea. If I get back less than what I invest, it's not worth investing in it. The second idea, which we covered in November, was called portfolio theory and the capital asset pricing model. That idea comes from the fact that when you calculate the net present value of anything, you need a discount rate, you need an interest rate. Where does that interest rate come from? Well, Markowitz and Sharp got a Nobel Prize for coming up with the concept of the capital asset pricing model. Today, we're going to talk about the third big idea of finance, that we call capital structure theory. And again, two people, Modiglani and Miller, got Nobel Prizes in separate years for exactly the same type of idea. Modiglani got it for a slightly different topic, life cycle theory, but it's very similar, so I'm combining them for this idea. The fourth big idea is option pricing, which we'll cover next month, and Scholes and Merton got a Nobel Prize for that one. Asymmetric information, Akerlof, Spence, and Stiglitz got a Nobel Prize for that one. And the final idea, market efficiency, where an enormous number of people have Nobel Prizes, except that nobody really knows what that means. Right? So the last idea is possibly the most controversial, so I'm going to save that for the final lecture of this series. So, at its core, what is finance all about? Right? Essentially, finance is about one thing, and that is basically promises. People are basically, you're saying to you, look, I'm going to give you some fantastically large amount in the future if you give me money today. That's it. That's everything in finance is about that. Right? Invest in my company, I'll give you returns. Invest in my investment project, whatever it is, I'll give you some extraordinary sum of money back. And of course, the question is going to be, what are these promises worth? So to understand that, the first big idea of finance, net present value, says, as I said, the present value of all these promises today, you have to compare it to the amount you're investing, right? Because the key is, some of these cash flows will be 5-10 years in the future. Give me money today, and I'll give you money in the future. But how do you compare money in the future to money today? You can't compare them because they're apples and oranges. So net present value allows you to bring all those cash flows together to one point in time, today's value. That's why we call it net present value. Right? Basic story in finance. It's used everywhere in finance. And the basic formula is the present value of something is the present value of its cash flows in the future. So you've got somebody promising you $100 one year from now. You do $100 divided by 1 plus the discount rate to the power of 1 year from now. Another $1,000 2 years from now, 1,000 divided by 1 plus r squared 2 years from now, and so on. Right? Okay, now, the problem here, of course, is you needed to have an interest rate. Right? So where did that interest rate come from? That's the second big idea of finance. What is the right discount rate? So here the problem is, you're turning now to the investor side of the picture. The first idea was the firm choosing to invest in something, we are making an investment decision. The second idea is the people who are faced with providing the financing for that investment decision. For example, somebody comes to you and says, please invest in my company. I'm going to give you fantastic returns. Of course, you can compute the cash flows, but the question is, what discount rate do you use? So here the answer is, you want to ask yourself, if I don't invest in this company, what am I going to do with my money? I'm not just going to keep it under my bed. I have to invest it in something. And so what I'm looking for is, what's the opportunity cost of investing in this company? If I don't invest in this company, what opportunity am I giving up? Right? So the discount rate is interest rate on the next best available opportunity. That opportunity should have the same level of risk. And the entire lecture on portfolio theory said, risk is measured by looking at what you're already holding. And basically, Markowitz and Sharp said, every rational investor should hold only two assets, a risk-free asset, a government bond, and a market portfolio, right? Consisting of every asset in the world. So the risk is measured by how much additional risk do you take on by adding your stock to this market portfolio. And of course, the formula there is the standardized covariance is called the beta, and the CAPM just says the discount rate is equal to the risk-free rate plus the beta times RM minus RF. That's a formula we concluded with last time. Okay? So this is, all these ideas are connected. If one of these ideas fails, every idea fails. So finance is kind of these six topics all have to hold, otherwise finance falls apart. So you need to know this before we actually go to the next point here. So the third question we're going to ask is, well, going back now to the firm. So I am now a firm manager. And as a manager, I'm asking, okay, where should I get the money? Right? I need to invest in this opportunity, but I have all these investors to approach. Which investor do I ask for to give me money? And the reason is, it's not about which investor in particular, it's which contract I offer them. For example, I can have one choice. I can borrow, I can issue debt. Okay? So if I borrow money, basically I'm promising somebody a steady stream of interest cash flows and maybe the money back at the end. And in return, I get their money up front. Okay? What are the cons of this? Well, the big con is I have to pay interest every year. Right? I can't get away from that. It's a legal obligation. But what's the pro here? The pro is I don't give up control of my company. I still own my company completely. Okay, what about the second choice? The second choice is issue equity, right? Rather than issuing interest and you have to issuing debt and you have to pay the same interest every year, you say, I'll give you a share in my profits. So if I make a lot of money, you make a lot of money. I lose money, you lose money, right? I can't guarantee you anything. So what's the con here? Well, the con here is you might lose control of the company, right? So you issue too much equity, you don't control that equity, people can say, we don't need you as a manager in the company anymore. You get fired even though it is your company. This is what happened, for example, to Steve Jobs in 1990s when, you know, Apple kicked him out. He later came back in. It also happened to Sam Altman at OpenAI last year, even though that wasn't, you know, a commercial company in that sense. Anyway, the pro, of course, is it's flexible. You don't have to pay dividends every year. Sometimes, you know, if you choose, you can pay dividends. If you don't choose, you need not pay dividends. So these are the major choices, the two big choices you have. You have a whole bunch of different types of subsidiary choices. You can issue particular types of debt. You can say, okay, this is a contingent form of debt. If I do really well, you can convert the debt to equity. That could be like a convertible bond, things like that, right? But in essence, these are the two big choices companies have. Choice number one, issue debt, steady stream of cash flows, but you have to pay those cash flows. You cannot get away from them. Choice two, issue equity, which can fluctuate depending on where they, how much money you're making. But, you know, you might lose control of the company, right? So how do you choose what to finance a company with? That's a question we are facing. Now, one way to look at this is to say, let's see what companies actually do, right? So what I have here is sort of like an aggregate balance sheet for manufacturing companies in America. And on the left-hand side, we see current assets, we see fixed assets. On the right-hand side, we see liabilities, both short-term and long-term, and equity. Those are the major parts of a balance sheet. They equate each other. Now, if you look at this and say, how much debt and how much equity do firms issue on average? One might say, okay, well, you can see that the total amount of debt, both short and long-term, is given by this number here and this number here, right? That's the total amount of debt you've issued. This is the total value of the company. So one way of looking at this is to say debt over total assets is about 60%. Another way of looking at it is to say, well, you know, the current liabilities, they're sort of offset by the current assets. So what are current liabilities? They're short-term stuff. So for example, if you're running a restaurant, accounts receivable, accounts payable. Accounts receivable, current assets, accounts payable, current liabilities. So you can say, okay, people owe me money, and when they owe me money, when they pay me, I can pay the people I owe. So they sort of cancel each other. Accounts receivable cancels account payable, and so on. So another way of looking at it is, the only thing that matters, you take this out, these two cancel each other. The only thing that matters is looking at the long-term liabilities of the company and taking the sum of those two. So what you have here is long-term liabilities divided by long-term liabilities plus equity, another way of looking at the debt-equity ratio. Okay, so on average, you can say, in American companies, 60% total debt, maybe 45 to 50% long-term debt. Okay, but that's not the whole story, right? So if you actually go and in detail and look at what the pattern is by industry, what we find is the numbers are all over the place. So, for example, you can have internet information providers, almost no debt at all. We have semiconductors, almost no debt. All the way down to hotels, significant amounts of debt. And airlines, 96% of debt. So different industries seem to finance themselves in different ways. Okay? So that's one problem. You have to explain the cross-sectional structure of debt within the firm. Okay. But the numbers also change over time. So that same number, the aggregate number I showed you, changes every year. What we have here is, on the top part, we have the investments within the firm. These investments need to be financed in some way or the other. Most of it comes from internal expenditure, right? So basically, you're looking at capital expenditure is much more significant than anything else. So big things the company does obviously uses up a lot more money than the working capital. There's short-term, small stuff. But where is that financed? Well, if you look at where it is financed, most of it comes from internally generated cash. Right? So the company generates profits, and they use the profit to plow it back into the company, and they finance the investments that way. Okay, but what about the remaining amount? Well, do they issue debt? Do they issue equity? The answer is, it depends on the year. So for example, if you look at this, in 1992, what do we see? We see that the company issued a lot of debt, and they bought back shares. Okay, fine. What about 1993? Well, they bought back debt and they issued shares. What about 1992? Well, they issued both debt and equity. There's no pattern. And every year, the numbers change. So what we have is, cross-sectionally, the patterns are different in different industries. In the time series, the numbers are different over time. And it gets worse. It changes across countries as well. Different countries use different levels of debt. These were the problems that Modiglani and Miller were faced with when they were trying to come up with one idea what explains the structure of capital within a company. This is the problem they had. Now, if you went before Modiglani Miller came along, you went to a consultant for advice, right? You're a CEO of a company. So you go to your consultant and you say, look, I need to raise money for my internal investment. What should I do? Should I issue debt? Should I issue equity? One group of guys would say, borrow. And you say, why? And they say, well, I've done the study. There are 3,000 companies in my sample, and I've checked every time they issued debt, what happened? The share price went up. The value increased. So this is a good thing to do. Issuing debt, the market seems to like it. Fine, you say, but you want a second opinion. So you go to a different consultant. The second consultant says, no, that's not a good idea. Issue equity. Why? Because I've looked at a different batch of 3,000 companies, and whenever they issued debt, the value went down. So you have different consultants all coming up with different pieces of advice. Nobody could tell what's the right thing to do, right? So the issuing equity people say, well, you know, if you borrow, you could go bankrupt. You could lose everything. Don't borrow too much. But how much is too much? 20%, 40%, 80%? Nobody knew. So this is where Modiglani Miller came in. Now, how do you think they approached that problem? Right? One would imagine they would go and talk to a whole bunch of companies and ask them how they issue debt and equity, right? Yeah, I see a bunch of nodding heads. Nope, they didn't do that. What they did was to lock themselves into their office and think. So this is entirely a thought experiment. There was nothing there which actually involved talking to a manager. They didn't do that, right? They said, in principle, how can we come up with this from first principles? So what was their major insight which got them a Nobel Prize? Well, what they said was very simple. When you issue debt or equity, the companies don't just keep the money, right? It's not like, you know, remember the Uncle Scrooge comics where Uncle Scrooge takes a whole bunch of money, coins, and puts it in a swimming pool and tries to swim in the money. They don't do that, right? They actually invest the money. They do something with the money. So a company issues debt, does something with the money, and the value goes up. Why? One reason, the debt itself is valuable. Second reason, the stuff they invested in, that was valuable. The debt was bad, but they invested in something which was so good, it counteracted the negative impact on the debt. So the problem is, by actually investing, you are using up, you're creating or destroying value by investing in a positive or a negative NPV project. Okay? That's the issue they had. So, but the NPV of the project is the investment side. It has nothing to do with the financing side. The financing side is about the choice between debt and equity. The investment side is NPV, which you already talked about. So Modiglani Miller said, what we need to do is not look at a typical company situation. What we need to do is study what are called leverage recaps. So what is a leverage recapitalization? The answer is very simple. Let's take a typical company. So you have assets and a mixture of debt and equity financing the assets, right? So it's a balance sheet, so the assets are equal to the liabilities. Fine. Now, the company starts to do a recap. What it does is it issues debt. But what does it do with the money? It doesn't invest in anything. What it does is takes the money and buys shares back. That means it adjusts the equity side of the balance sheet. Right? It never goes to the left-hand side. It never touches the assets. So if it issues debt, it buys back shares. If it issues shares, it buys back debt. So essentially what's happening is that it is changing the right-hand side of the balance sheet without touching the left-hand side. So now, if this happens and the value goes down, why is it going down? It can only be because of the debt. It can't be because the company is investing, because the company is not investing. right? We have fixed that part. So everything that's happening is done on the right-hand side. So one possibility could be you issue debt and the value goes down. The other possibility could be you issue debt and the value goes up. But all of this will be due entirely to that mixture of debt and equity which you have within the firm. Right? So that's what they did. That was the entire insight they had. They said, let's look at a world where all the firm is doing, issues debt, buys back shares. Issues shares, buys back debt. I'm not going to invest. I'm not touching that side. There's no NPV involved. If there's a change in value, it must be because of capital structure. Okay, so we need a little bit of notation here. I'll explain that notation too. The notation is going to be a little complex, so I'll show you what the notation means in a pictorial format in a bit. So at the moment, I'm going to call a firm which has no debt at all. We start with a completely unlevered firm. The firm has no debt, that's why it's called unlevered. Okay? So the value of that firm must be equal to the value of the equity because it has no debt. It's unlevered. So the assets must be equal to equity. That's it, balance sheet. Second thing, we have a levered firm, which is identical in the asset side to the unlevered firm. What does that mean? It means they have similar growth opportunities. They have similar investment projects. The CEOs are clones of each other. Right? Identical along all lines, except firm two. Partly financed with debt and partly financed with equity. All right. Third thing, the company can choose to borrow. And if it borrows, it pays a cost of RD, cost of debt, on its borrowing rate. Right. Fourth thing is the cost of equity. And that's derived by the capital asset pricing model, which we did last time. The cost of equity is how much do shareholders want if you choose to invest in that company. Finally, we have the cost of assets of the firm, which is the same as the cost of equity for a firm which has zero debt, because the assets for that firm is equal to the equity in that firm. I'll show you this in a little bit. The weighted average cost of capital is our final number, and that's a weighted average of every form of financing the firm has. For example, it's paying RD on its debt, but this is the level of debt within the firm. So that's the weight which you put on the debt. And similarly, the weight you put on the equity, that's an overall weighted average cost of capital on the firm. Now, let's explain this a little better. So what we have here is straightforward. You have an unlevered firm, firm with no debt at all. Okay? So the assets are generating returns. Right? I mean, they're assets, so you're investing in them, they're generating returns. So those returns are called RA, the cost, the return on the assets of the firm. But because the firm has no debt, it's the same as writing the cost of equity when the firm has no debt, RE when debt is zero. Okay? Fine. What about a levered firm? Levered firm, the asset side is still the asset side. It's RA. It's just generating the same assets, so they're generating the same returns. But on the right-hand side, we've got debt and we've got equity. The debt has an interest rate of RD. The equity has an interest rate of RE. So that's what we have, is the weighted average cost of capital is a weighted average of the RD and the RE. Right? And what are the weights? How much debt is there in the firm? How much equity is there in the firm? Okay? So very straightforward formula. And that's the overall cost of capital for the firm. Weighted average of the debt and the equity. There's only two forms of debt here. Only two forms of financing here. If you had more forms, you would add them on. Preferred shares, convertible debt, whatever. Cost of each, take the weighted average of all those costs together. That's a relevant cost of capital for this firm. Fine. So what are the questions we want to answer? The value of the unlevered firm is VU. The value of the levered firm is VL. So the first question you want to answer is, the value of the levered firm different from the value of the unlevered firm? That means in some way has issuing debt changed the value of the firm? Second question, what happens to the cost of equity? If you issue debt, Does the cost of equity change? And a third question is, what happens to the firm's overall cost of capital as you add debt to the capital structure? Right? So three big questions. Is the value of the levered firm equal to the value of the unlevered firm, or is it different in some way? Second question, what happens to the cost of equity? Do shareholders care about this? Third question, what happens to the firm's overall cost of capital? Okay? And the answers to these three questions was what got Modiglani and Miller the Nobel Prize. So let's see what they did. Let's start with a perfect world. Now remember, Modiglani and Miller were both economists from the University of Chicago. Right? For those of you who are familiar with economists from the University of Chicago, their idea of a perfect world is very different from our idea of perfect worlds. So what do Chicago economists think makes a perfect world? First thing they say is there should be no government. Right? Of course, that means no taxes. Right? That means no lawyers, no bankruptcy costs, no transaction costs, and of course, efficient markets. Right? So this is the ideal world for an economist from the University of Chicago. So let's start with this world, perfect. Fine. In this world, the proposition one, which they came up with, was to say, and by the way, the perfect world doesn't exist, right? So that's why it was a thought experiment. The beauty of their approach was that they said, let's start with this perfect world and then relax one assumption at a time to see how far we can get with what's the optimal structure of the firm. Okay? So initially, all these assumptions, perfect world, and they said in that world, the value of the firm doesn't change. That means, in other words, the value of the levered firm is equal to the value of the unlevered firm. Second thing they said was, shareholders think it's riskier now. So what do shareholders do? They ask for higher returns. Otherwise, they won't invest in the company. Right? So the rate of return demanded by equity holders goes up, and it's given by the cost of assets plus cost of assets minus the cost of debt times the debt-equity ratio of the company. I'll come back to this. The third one says, but even then, even though the shareholders are asking for more money, the weighted average cost of capital of the firm stays the same. It never changes. So let's prove this, okay? So we are now coming up on proving three Nobel Prize winning formulae. So you have to dust off all the mathematics we did in our high school. Are you ready, everybody? Right? Excellent. Let's do it. So, proposition one. And the proof is actually very simple. We call it the pizza proof. Okay? So you have here a pizza which costs £10. All right? So you decide to sell 1/4 of that pizza. Okay? So the question for you, and I'm going to start over here, is how much would you start for selling that 1/4 slice of the pizza? You can use that QR code and slide on your phone to try to figure out exactly how much you would pay for 1/4 of the pizza. Right? You can charge any price you want. What price would you charge? Excellent. I can say that a lot of you would be charging about £4 for a slice of pizza. Excellent, that's totally fine. Of course, remember, this is University of Chicago. And remember the first assumption we made, perfect competition. The moment you charge £4 for 1/4 of the pizza, what is the immediate thing which will happen if the market is perfect? Somebody else will jump in and undercut you, right? So you charge £4, they'll charge £3.99. You charge £3.99, they'll charge £3.98. And so, literally, the only price at which you cannot, you know, make a profit or a loss is 2.5. You can charge less than 2.5, but then you're giving up money. You're leaving money on the table. So literally, what they said was, you want to sell a quarter of the pizza? You have to sell it for 2.5. You cannot sell it for more than that because of competition. You can't sell it for less than that because you're not stupid. Right? So that's the basic story here. So the only price is 2.5. So what that means is, now what do you have? You've sold your pizza, originally 10 pounds, sold a quarter, you ended up with 2.5. And you end up with 3/4 of a pizza worth 7.5. The question is, are you wealthier than before? Not really, right? One pizza worth 10 pounds, 3/4 of pizza worth 7.5 plus 2.5 in cash, exactly the same thing. So really, you're not better off than before. And that's the proof. Now I can see a lot of faces say, wait, what kind of proof is that, right? I mean, they got a Nobel Prize for that. So let me get a little more sophisticated here, okay? So by the way, that's how they actually explained their thing to the, so when Miller got the prize, a whole bunch of journalists went to him and they said, Professor, can you explain why you got the prize, you know, in ways that our readers can understand? And he used the pizza proof. It was not in the paper. This is how he described it to the journalists. And the journalist said, oh, interesting. Can we talk to someone else? Because they're like, what the hell, right? They didn't understand this proof. So let's talk about a different way of doing it. Okay? So imagine that you have an unlevered firm, and this is what you have, right? So the firm has no debt at all, so it makes $100 in earnings every year, pays zero interest because it's unlevered, and that money goes to the net income of the firm. What does the firm do with it? Gives it out in the form of dividends. Okay? This is an unlevered firm, no interest, done. Okay, you own 10% of the shares. So that means your income every year is $10, and you're happy. Okay? Maybe not ecstatic, but you're happy. All right, now the firm says, I'm going to issue $200 of debt, paying 10%. Okay, so what happens to the balance sheet of the firm? Well, earnings are still the same, but interest goes up from 0 to 20. That means the net income drops to 80, and the firm pays that out. So you have $80 of dividends, which you're getting. Remember, you own 10% of the shares, so your income is now $8. Okay? The question I'm going to ask you is, would you be happy? Somebody is happy. Oh, that's nice. Two people, okay? I really want to speak to these people after the seminar. Okay, so we see it's a sort of even thing between I'm angry and it doesn't matter to me. But the actual answer is correct. It shouldn't matter. I'll tell you why. And this seems obvious, right? I mean, as you can see over here, the angry part overwhelms it doesn't matter, right? This is, again, why they got a Nobel Prize. And because it's not intuitive. Okay, let's go back in here. Remember, the key part is, if your firm is issuing debt, the money has to go somewhere. It cannot invest this money. So what does it do with this money? It has to give it to the shareholders. And she gives it to the shareholders as a special dividend. Okay? It can't touch the asset side, because remember, it's a leverage recap. If the firm issues debt, it has to do something with that money. So you assume it either buys back shares or it gives the money to the shareholders. So if I give the money to you as a shareholder, you own 10% of the company, how much do you get? 200, 10% of the company, you get $20. Now what do you do with this $20? You put it in the bank. How much is the bank paying? 10%, perfectly competitive. So you get $2 of interest now and $8 of income. Are you happy? It's the same as before. It hasn't changed. Okay? That was the intuition Mother Glanda Miller said. The firm decides to take on leverage, you can undo whatever the firm does by doing exactly the opposite. The firm issues debt, you say, fine, I lend exactly that amount. Okay? Let's go to a slightly different scenario. Here, there's a levered firm which is giving you $100, $20 of interest, $80 is your net income, and the dividend is $80. So you're going along, and you own 10% of shares, you're getting an income of $8 a share. Okay? It's pretty good. And now the firm says, you know what? I don't like bondholders. I don't like debt. I think debt is bad. I'm going to buy back all my debt. Fine. So what happens? Your earnings now are still 100. That hasn't changed. The interest has gone to zero. And dividends is 100, and you own 10% of the shares, so your income is now $10, higher than before. Question is, brilliant. Everybody got the story, right? So the answer is, again, it shouldn't matter. Why? Because the firm is buying back debt. This person here is still a little angry, but I would say, don't worry too much about it, because the key part is the firm needs the money from somewhere, right? It's buying back debt. So where does it get that money from? It has to be from the shareholders. You own 10% of the company, so it's going to put you on the hook for $20. So you give the firm $20, right? Where do you get the money from? You have to borrow it. If you borrow it, you pay 10%. So yes, you get $10 of dividends, but you pay $2 of interest. So you still end up with the same $8 as before. Okay? So the income never changes. Here, the firm has reduced its debt, so you take on debt. You undone whatever the firm has done. That was the essence of Modi Gandhi Miller Proposition 1. It shouldn't matter, in a perfect world, what the firm does, because the money has to come from somewhere. Right? You can't create money. It has to come from somewhere. Okay, the Proposition 2 said the shareholders are asking for more money. Right? The shareholders, in some way, their risk has gone up, and it's given by this formula here. So why is that happening? Why are they asking for more money? Remember, it's a perfect world, which means no bankruptcy costs. It's not about bankruptcy. There's something else. Let's imagine that you have an investment opportunity that costs you $100, and it can either give you $101 or $99. That means, essentially, your returns are either 1% or minus 1%. You make one or you lose one. But suppose you don't actually put in the entire $100 yourself. What you do is you go to your mother and you borrow $99 from your mother. Okay? Why your mother? Because your mother is a nice person and she will not charge you any interest. Okay? So putting interest in makes it a little more difficult, so I'm going to assume mother because nice people, right? Okay, so now you own 101, so the only thing you have to do is give your mom her money back. She's not asking for interest. She just wants her money back. So 101, you return 99, your profit is 2. Here you own 99, return 99, your profit is 0. But how much money had you put in? $1. $1 becomes 2. That's a return of 100%. $1 becomes 0. That's a return of minus 100%. Same investment opportunity, but leverage boosts the positive and the negative. That's why leverage is risky. Makes returns much more volatile than before. Okay, what happens to the firm's overall cost of capital? Well, let's say you're the CFO of an all-equity finance firm. Your CEO comes to you and says, our cost of equity, which is the cost of assets because the firm has no debt, is 12%. Okay, the cost of debt is 6%. Why don't we borrow? The shareholders are asking for 12, the bondholders are asking for 6. Let's issue 50% debt. What do you say? This is a great idea, a terrible idea, it doesn't matter. Remember, the cost of debt is 6%, the cost of equity is 12%. You guys are very, very good. Okay. It does look like it's a great idea because the cost of debt is lower than the cost of equity. The key point, of course, is the moment you issue the debt, the shareholders will ask for more money. They say, look, it's riskier for us. How much more money? Let's take Proposition 2. It says that's 12% plus 12% minus 6% times 1, because 50% debt, 50% equity, the shareholders are going to immediately ask for 18%. The bondholders are still asking for 6, but the average of 6 and 18 is still 12%. So what does the CEO say? Well, the CEO might say, what? Stupid shareholders, they keep so greedy, they're asking for more and more. Fine, I'm going to get rid of more of them. I'm going to get rid of all except for one guy. That means I'm going to go for 99.99999% debt. What happens to the cost of capital? One shareholder, everybody else, a bondholder, who's asking for 6%? But that one shareholder now asks for 1.5%. The average of 1.5% and 6% is still 12%. So then the CEO says, let's get rid of the last guy. All buy back all the shares. What do the bondholders ask for? Well, one might say 6%, but remember, the definition of an equity holder is somebody who's paid after everybody else has paid off. So if there are no bond, if there are no shareholders in the firm, who's last in line? The bondholders, which means the bondholders become the equity holders, which means they ask for 12%. Right? So the cost of capital never changes. So the traditional view of the cost of capital was, as you issue more debt, the cost of equity goes up, but the cost of debt goes up too. So the weighted average cost of capital kind of goes down a little bit in the beginning and then goes up in the end. What Modiglani Miller said, in a perfect world, cost of equity does go up, but the cost of debt stays the same, so the weighted average cost of capital never changes. All right. Now, let's add the first imperfection, taxes. If you remember this from the first lecture this year, what I said was this was the flow of finance within the firm. And what I have here is a leakage, right? From the point of view, again, going back to Chicago, the point of view is if I pay money here, that means I have less money to pay here. If I pay less money here, these guys will give me less money. So this is a problem, right? I want to minimize the amount I pay. So basically, how do they do that? So they're going to relax assumption one. Now there's a government and there are taxes, but only corporate taxes, and the corporate taxes is the tax rate of tau C. Okay? So again, we have a weighted average cost of capital, but now I've added 1 minus tax rate because now I'm looking at the after-tax cost of debt. Debt cost me 10%, but I'm saving 40% of taxes, so it actually only cost me 6%. That's the idea. Fine. Same three questions. Is VL different from VU? How does the cost of equity change? And what happens to the firm's overall cost of capital? And in this corporate tax world, Proposition 1 says debt is good. Take as much debt as you can. More debt, the better. Why? Because it reduces your taxes. The second one says, the formula is the value of the levered firm, value of the unlevered firm, plus the tax shield in the debt. Proposition 2 says the cost of equity goes up, but not as much as before, because the shareholders are protected by a tax shield. They're getting money back from the government. And the third one says that the firm's overall cost of capital goes down, is given by that formula. There are variants of this formula depending on the assumptions you make about the type of debt, but we'll ignore that for now. Okay? So how do we prove it? Well, assume you have an all-equity firm, and you have a levered firm over here. So you come in. Let's say it's, again, the pizza proof. You go in every day to your school, and you're carrying this big pizza with you, and there's this giant bully at the door who stops you and takes away half your pizza. The bully is, of course, the government. Right? So, but you realize that the bully only checks for pizza, doesn't actually check for cash. So what you do is, before the bully gets in, right, you sell half the pizza to your teacher. And then you keep the money in your shoe and walk through. The pizza sees only half. The bully only sees half the pizza and takes half of that. So the bully only takes a quarter of the pizza, not the half of the pizza. You're left with cash plus the quarter of the pizza you have left, which means you're better off than before. Essentially, that's the scenario here, that's the scenario here, and that's the idea. What's left over for the shareholder, the bondholder, is bigger if you pay less taxes. To prove that, very straightforward. You've got same thing, unlevered firm. But the key difference here is the taxes are 40% and the firm is paying that. You own 10% of the shares, your income is $6. The firm issues $200 of debt, paying 10%. What happens? Well, you pay the debt, but your taxes go down from 40 to 32. Your net income is 48, dividends are therefore 48, and so your income is 4.8. If you ask the question, are you happy? The answer is yes. Why? Because you get $2 of interest from that debt. Remember, the firm has to issue the debt and gives you the 20 bucks, so you use that to invest. And you get 4.8, so you end up with 8 cents more than before, 80 cents more than before. So every year, you get 80 cents more. Where is the 80 cents coming from? Well, look at the taxes. right? $20 of interest saves you 20 times 40% of taxes. You own 10% of the share, so you save 80 cents every year. So you want to find out, every year, you're saving 80 cents. What is the present value of that stream, infinite stream of 80 cents a year? How do you find the present value of an infinite stream of cash flows? Basically, you're looking for a formula that goes on like the same NPV formula, but goes on forever. How do you solve that? Well, it's very straightforward. You say the present value is that number. Multiply both sides by 1 plus r. That first one becomes c. So this cancels. This becomes 1. This becomes 2, and so on. So what you see is the second formula. But this whole bit here is the same as the first top formula. So PV times 1 plus R, C plus PV. And you can solve that to just say present value C over R. Now, you're getting 80 cents every year. So that's the cash flow you're getting every year. So what is the value of that 80 cents? Well, 80 cents divided by R, 200 times 10% times 40% divided by R. But what's the R? Well, you only get the tax shield if you can pay your interest. So the risk of the tax shield is exactly the risk of the interest. That means the R must be 10%. So putting that in the formula, you get the 10% cancels, the RD cancels, and that was Modigliani-Miller Proposition 1. Okay. Fine. So what can we conclude so far? Well, in a perfect world, capital structure doesn't matter. But in a world with taxes, debt is good. Borrow as much as you can. Right? Okay. Are they really important in corporate policy? Well, let's take an example. A Belgian tax reform in 1982. What happened here was, for some reason, I'm not quite sure why, the Belgian government decided that debt has a cost, equity will give you a cost of 13%, and every firm can deduct that cost from its income statement. So what happened? Turns out more equity was issued in those 2 years than the previous 13 years. The entire Belgian stock market went up by 40% in 1 month. Why? Because everybody said, whoa, tax shield. And every time an equity announcement happened, the share price went up because they said, oh, these guys are taking advantage of a tax shield. Right? So what about personal taxes? Remember, you're getting $2 of interest, but you're paying taxes on that, right? So shouldn't it affect the value of the firm? Well, unfortunately, now it starts getting complicated. The problem is, we don't know what the shareholders are paying. So, for example, if you are paying heavy personal taxes, you may want the firm to pay taxes, not you. But if you're a pension fund or an endowment, you're tax exempt, so you don't really care that much about what the firm is doing. You're happy to take the interest up front. Or it can be, well, the firms can balance. Some shareholders pay taxes, some don't, but this requires you to know who your shareholders are. So really, Modigliani-Miller didn't have an answer to this. Their basic story was, if you have a big enough pool and the shareholders have to pay taxes, they will go away from your company, but somebody else will replace them. So in effect, you can treat it like the same thing holds in the presence of taxes. All right, so what is the optimal amount of debt? What do we can we conclude? Well, Modigliani-Miller 1 says, take as much debt as you can. But we don't see this. We don't see companies with 100% debt or even 99% debt. So why not? Well, we have to relax assumption 2. Right? No lawyers, no bankruptcy costs. Now we have lawyers and bankruptcy costs. So what do these guys do? Well, the first thing it does is it reduces your flexibility. Right? Imagine a company has a lot of debt. You think it's going to go bankrupt. Are you going to buy the products of this firm? Let's say it's making laptops. Right? Are you going to buy a laptop from a company which has a severe amount of debt? No, because you don't know what the after-sales service can be. You don't even know if the company will exist 1 year from now. So even the presence of too much debt means that people will back away from the company. You will not be able to hire good employees because nobody wants to join a company which might go bankrupt. Okay. All right, second problem is excessive risk-taking. Companies going bankrupt, what they will do is take all sorts of risks. Why? Because the costs are borne by the bondholders. Or they might underinvest. So that means basically if a good opportunity arises, they won't take it because the benefits will go to the bondholders. The company will be safer. Why should they choose to invest in that project. These are called the agency costs of debt. So this leads to what we call the trade-off theory of capital structure. The trade-off theory of capital structure says the value of a firm is the value of an unlevered firm, plus the present value of the interest tax shield, plus the incentive benefits of debt. Some debt is good because managers know that they have to service that debt. Otherwise, the company goes bankrupt, they all lose their jobs. If you have too much cash, you are tempted to spend it on yourself. Right? Think about all of us when we have our annual budgets and you don't use your budget before the end of the year. What happens? The budget disappears. So a lot of us, towards the end of the year, we buy a lot of stuff we don't need. New laptops, new whatever, right? Because otherwise the money goes. And next year they say, oh, you didn't use it last year. We cut your budget this year. Sound familiar? Right? A lot of people. Okay. So that's the incentive benefits of debt. Financial distress costs and the agency costs of debt reduce that value. So who has high debt? If you have high free cash flows, you need the tax shield. If you have stable cash flows, there's a low probability of financial distress. If you have lots of tangible capital, financial distress is less costly, so you might choose to have that level of debt. Few growth opportunities, you don't need fundraising, so debt overhang is not a problem. So these are the companies which has high levels of debt. Okay? So this theory of capital structure basically says that if you go with Modigliani-Miller proposition one, you end up here. Right? In the perfect, in the world with taxes. If you're thinking about agency costs and the value of distress costs, firms balance the two together and they trade off one versus the other. Every firm has an optimal level of debt. Okay. So how do firms establish capital structure in reality? Well, there's some people that, there's a survey being done by Graham and Harvey at Duke, and they say that most companies do actually have a target capital structure in mind, how much to borrow. They know what is good for them and what is not. And you ask them what affects debt policy, they will tell you things like credit rating, insufficient internal funds, level of interest rate. These are all things which work with Modigliani and Miller. Right? But the second, so most corporations in general have low debt asset ratios. Changes in financial leverage have been shown to affect firm value. And there seem to be differences in capital structure across industries, which we can now explain. Right? For example, airlines. The assets are leased assets. They can easily be taken away. It's stable things. Internet information providers, the assets are the engineers. You can't handcuff them to their desks. They won't want debt, because if they take too much debt, the engineers will leave if they think the firm is going to go bankrupt, and the firm will definitely go bankrupt. So that's it. And there's evidence that firms behave as if they had a target debt equity ratio. But it doesn't explain everything. For example, lots of profitable firms have no leverage at all. For example, from 1962 to 2009, about 10% had zero debt, no debt at all. Zero leverage firm, and they stay year after year. They never take debt. And they pay higher dividends, they have the money, they pay higher taxes. Why are they paying higher taxes? That was a paper called The Mystery of Zero Leverage Firms, which is a very American thing. Why are these guys paying taxes when they don't have to? So what can we conclude about capital structure? In a perfect world, capital structure doesn't matter. So what's a perfect world? Capital structure shouldn't affect the free cash flow. The asset side of the balance sheet is completely independent of the liability side of the balance sheet. Capital structure decision doesn't reveal any new information. Right? Third thing, investors and firms can trade the same set of securities at the same price. No taxes, no transaction costs, no issuance costs. But even in perfect capital markets, capital structure does affect something. The risk of equity increases when you issue debt. So, in a world with taxes, it pays to borrow. So borrow as much as you can. But, of course, companies do not borrow as much as they can. They trade off the tax benefits of debt from the financial distress cost of too much debt. And they end up with an optimal capital structure. Unfortunately, this doesn't explain everything. Some firms don't even appear to think about this tax benefit. They can borrow even when they can easily pay their debts. So that last example is a different theory of capital structure, which I'm not going to talk about today. That will be in the topic of asymmetric information. So the informational effects when you start issuing debt, we will spend some time talking about it, I believe, in May. Right? But for now, this is what we can conclude about capital structure. And that's it.
What I'm going to do is take a couple of the questions online first, and then our colleague will bring the mic to the fore. So, Professor Rao, a couple of questions. You spoke about promises and the perfect world. It's something that resonated with myself and one of the questions online. First question, how do you account for such poor returns in the real world versus the assumptions in the perfect world?
Well, the perfect world is a pure thought experiment, right? There's nothing, I mean, it's not like we're expected to believe it exists. It's the thing about, this is this mythical paradise which we are supposed to live in, and in a mythical paradise, nothing matters. Capital structure doesn't matter. In the real world, our returns are very different. It's not just taxes, it's bankruptcy costs, it's informational effects. In this class, in this session, I haven't talked about information. Because the moment you issue something, that reveals information to the market, and the market reacts to that information. So returns in the real world have very little connection with returns in the perfect Modigliani-Miller world. And they just tap the beginning. But it was a good way to think about how do you separate the investment decision of the firm from the capital structure decision of the firm.
What you present tonight is very rational. How do you account for irrational behavior and decisions?
That's a very good question. And in fact, I'm going to address those in my final lecture on market efficiency. So we'll hold off on that. There are a lot of factors. For example, there's a paper by Ulrike Malmendier, and there's another paper by me, which show that CEOs, as we know, are humans. They are not Chicago rational economists. So there are lots of things that affect their choice to do something or not based on purely behavioral factors, such as they were born during the Great Depression, or even that they're married. Married CEOs take less risk than unmarried CEOs. Maybe one reason for that is they've used up their quota of risk when they got married, right? Or maybe they're more risk averse, who knows? But those are behavioral factors that affect capital structure.
We look forward to the sixth lecture in the series for that.
My question is about you mentioned earlier about the principal agent of the problem of the CEO. It's lead open to the over financialization. Or while what society expect from the firm is the value that they created, not just earned. So how to balance the value that firm created versus the over-financialization. Thank you.
Okay. So, as I mentioned in my first lecture, the idea of what firms are for has changed a lot since the 1920s, right? In the 1920s, there were a lot of people who believed that the reason firms were there were also to help society. But as I pointed out, over the last, from 1920 to 1970, when Friedman was the culmination of all this, they basically said, it's not our business to talk about, whether to help society or not. Our business is to do what's good for our shareholders. If the shareholders want to do what's good for the society, that's their issue. But they were, you're right, focused principally on principal agent problems. You let the managers do whatever they want, they will help themselves rather than help anybody else. So that was the overriding focus of those guys. You can't trust anybody, literally. Okay?
Okay. So can Modigliani and Miller's principles be expanded into other forms of issuing finance other than issuing debt and just equity and used by real-life companies?
Okay. Modigliani and Miller actually followed in a long tradition of what we call separation principles, right? So everything in finance involves separating one decision from another. So, for example, last time when we talked about portfolio theory and the capital asset pricing model, we talked about our first lecture, NPV. We separated the investment decision of the firm from the consumption decision of the shareholder. The shareholders want something, they can borrow and lend in the capital markets or where they want to go be. This is exactly the same idea. It's a separation. I can separate the investment decision of the firm from the financing decision of the firm. They're independent of each other. Everything in finance, and we'll see this in the next class as well, is about showing that each decision is independent of every other decision. So we don't need to worry about all the other ramifications. We can just focus on one particular area.
Your models earlier about the difference between debt and equity did not take account of the behavior of shareholders who buy and sell quite quickly. So a company that borrowed to buy its own shares to increase the share values, some people will be in there quick, get their 10% because the share value has gone up, and then sell again. Mm-hmm. And so you're not taking account of what shareholders do. They don't stay for a very long time in many cases. As somebody like me who's bought Nvidia and sold and bought again has made lots of money.
Yeah. That is an excellent point. This is a question of fairness and those kind of issues here. Unfortunately, finance doesn't concern itself very much about fairness. So, for example, if the company, you know, company issues shares or whatever, or makes a tender offer to buy back shares, and some shareholders are on holiday, some shareholders haven't, you know, kept up with the stuff, they will lose out. Some people will take advantage of that; they will make money. Other people will lose money. So, it's a wealth transfer between shareholders. So, there is a technical term for shareholders like this, and that is suckers. Right, so finance calls them, you know, you're not alert all the time, tough luck. Your problem, not mine, right? So this is, again, as I said, a very peculiarly heartless way to believe, right? But that's finance for you. There are no nice people in finance, I'm afraid. Okay.
Well, I think we're running short of time, so I'm just going to take one question online, which may be able to end this in a good way, which is, are there any real-world economies that come close to the perfect world you've described?
No. I can't think of a single one. I really can't think of a single one that fits exactly all the criteria we have. Most models start with that world, because then you can see, by relaxing each assumption, how do we get closer to the real world, and what is the impact of each assumption have?
I think the questionnaire here is probably asking to find a country which didn't have a government.
I'm sorry?
The questionnaire is probably trying to find a country that didn't have a government and came close to happiness for them.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
But on that note, I think, Professor Rao, many thanks again for your rich insights.
Thank you, Roshan.
And for simplifying the complex world of capital structures. Professor Rao, thank you.
Thank you.